Welcome to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik. It's great to have you with us today. The website is redicecreations.com. We do radio on Thursdays and Sundays, and don't forget to check out our webcasts as well. Now, if you're a regular listener, you've probably noticed that we're doing a kind of marathon with the speakers that will be attending the Alternative View event in London at the end of May this year. We are continuing with that trend here today. We've invited Tony Goslin to the program, another speaker that will be at the AV2 conference. If you're interested in reading more about this event, go to avii.co.uk or thealternativeview.co.uk and take a look around at that website. All information is up there for you. We'll be there, and we hope to see you there as well, of course. Now, Tony is behind the website Bilderberg.org that you might have come across in your searches for information about the Bilderberg meetings. He has been covering the Bilderbergers for quite some time. He has also been looking into media and ethics. He's been involved in the NUJ, the National Union of Journalists. He has a few other websites that you can take a look at as well. 911forum.org.uk and dialectradio.org.uk. He has his own show as well. On the Red Ice website, we will have these links available for you so you can find them more easily. And beyond going over some Bilderberg material today here with Tony, we're going to begin to talk a little bit about some of the current issues, one of these being the recent shootings in Northern Ireland. So some recent stuff here coming up. But let's get this program here going right away. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio, Tony. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Henrik. Thanks for asking me.
Just to set a little bit of background of you, so to speak, here, Tony, tell us just briefly about the Bilderberg.org website, when you started up and why.
Well, I mean, I'd worked in the 90s. In the 1990s, I started with a background in aviation, and I moved in the 1990s to work in broadcasting. And I was working in London for the BBC's London station and covering the terrorist outrages by the IRA in the early 1990s. I was doing that sort of stuff for about 3 or 4 years as a researcher and as a reporter. And then I kind of got disillusioned with not being able to do the sort of stuff I wanted to do on the radio. I found it was just sort of being blocked. And so I went on to do some environmental campaigning, and that's where I first heard of about the Bilderbergers. I was in a field, or sort of actually a sort of waste piece of waste ground, really, in just on the Thames near next to Wandsworth Bridge, and a chap came up to me. We were doing a land occupation, and a chap came up to me and said, "Have you heard about these Bilderberg guys? They actually control the whole of the Western world, and they meet up in secret, blah blah blah." Well, of course, I've heard this kind of thing before, but dutifully wrote down in my notebook the word Bilderberg. Anyway, it just so happened at the time, back in my office in Oxford, I had access to the Reuters article database. So I just thought, well, I'll put this thing into Reuters, see what he's talking about. And up popped the names of really the most powerful people in the Western world. And sure enough, there were secret meetings where the press was not being informed these meetings were taking place, even though there's most of the heads of the royalty of Europe were there too, as well as the World Bank, IMF, and all the rest. And so I thought, well, I mean, this does seem to be a much more powerful organisation than most of the press out or public know. Mm. And so I put up the names of the 1996 list of who'd attended these meetings up on the internet. Now, of course, the lists are one of the most interesting parts of it, but you know, the lists are likely to be part of what they are. I know they're partial. Certain very controversial or very, very powerful and well-known people, say, for example, somebody like Prince Charles or Prince Philip or the Queen, if they're attending these meetings, they don't really want their names on the list. So what they do is they sort of cherry-pick out of the list, the Bilderberg list, that some of the people that they think might draw too much attention to the meetings. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I have evidence of that. I've met people who have seen people at meetings, been to meetings, got evidence of people being at the meetings, and they're not on the official list. So really, that's how Bilderberg.org started, as a sort of website of lists of who's been to these meetings.
Hmm, interesting. And about the name, I've had this up on the as a question on the program before, and I know that the Bilderbergs were discovered by a journalist in the Netherlands at the Bilderberg Hotel at that point. But what I've been wondering, and maybe you have a good answer for that, is why would they call themselves the Bilderberg? Because wasn't this a name that was kind of given to them by the journalist that discovered them?
No, it was the Bilderberg Hotel they met in, which is owned by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. Now, he was a very central figure in setting up the Bilderberg conferences. Really important guy. I mean, he's dead now, but he was actually a German by birth, and he joined enthusiastically, although he denies it was enthusiastically, because I mean, you can't sort of at the early stages of Nazism, it was quite easy really to avoid getting involved, but you know, he didn't. He actually went and joined the SS, and it's a bit embarrassing really for him, because then he became quite a major figure in European politics after in Holland, you know, after the Second World War. So so there's this sort of core of a serious problem with Nazism at the core of the foundation of Bilderberg. But I mean, if you're looking at Prince Bernhard in a way was a kind of front man or manager for it. But the whole idea of Bilderberg was devised by the US. It was devised by the Council on Foreign Relations, War and Peace Study Groups, actually during World War II. And it was rolled out after World War II as part of the, I suppose, the American deal as to, well, we are going to help in World War II, but we are also going to try and control the outcome after the war. And it's a power, political influence network and financial influence network, because of course you put those two things together, you've got quite a lot of power. You've got all the bankers together, really, to influence politics in Europe and to be a kind of global, a Western think tank, like the Western think tank. And if you have a look at the list of the names of people that go to these things, the politicians, the bankers, and the royalty and the media people put together, plus of course all the main oil companies, of course Royal Dutch Shell and BP, people like that, then you really do have a list of the most powerful people in the Western world, at least financially. They certainly control most of the money in the Western world, and there's always people from the Bank for International Settlements, this secretive bank, which is right at the heart of the Bretton Woods global financial architecture, which has failed so miserably in the last few months.
Okay, we might return a little bit later then and talk more about the Bilderberg if we have time for that. But I know, Tony, that you want to touch upon some recent stuff that has been going on in Northern Ireland primarily. And maybe you can just give us a little bit of background story for those who might not have followed this particular story.
Well, over the last couple of weeks, we've had emerging of terrorist attacks in Northern Ireland. This is really quite frightening. We've had three people killed, two soldiers from the Royal Engineers at Mazarine Barracks in Antrim. And we've also had a Catholic policeman from the PSNI, Police Service for Northern Ireland, has also been killed. Now, this is particularly interesting for me immediately. The most significant is the fact that we've got private security, a private firm doing the security on the army barracks in Mazarine. Now, even though there were several shots fired, some initial shots from the car, and then apparently two gunmen ran over and literally, you know, shot these guys, at least killed a couple more. So it's two soldiers killed, and there was no returning fire from the army base. Now that's immediately a bit questionable and suspicious, but I'm glad to hear the private security have now been sacked from doing these army base duties in Northern Ireland. I mean, I can't imagine why several shots can be being fired and then there's no return fire. That sounds really bizarre to me straight away. But obviously there is some genuine sentiment in the Republican movement in Ireland. I mean, having lived in Northern Ireland, forgive me if I'm a little bit too jargonistic, but what I'll try and do is just lay out the problem over there. Is essentially you've got a Bosnia waiting to happen. You've got two communities that now come to peace, but there is still tensions between the Protestant, that is to say, the loyalist and unionist community, and the Catholics, that's the Republicans, and the nationalist community who want the United Ireland. There's still tension, and what's happened is literally just the day before this attack took place, Sir Hugh Orde, who's the rather suspect boss of the Northern Ireland Police, announced that they decided that they had to bring in their British intelligence back into the game in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. Now, as part of the agreement, the Good Friday Agreement, back in 1998, I think it was, which has brought peace to the province, and that was one of the things which was, the idea was that they were going to normalise security, so that is to say, put it back into the hands of the police, get the army intelligence who had, through the Force Research Unit and other covert organisations in Northern Ireland, had been basically planting bombs. I mean, the reason I think that this has happened is a mixture of two things. We've got, first of all, we've got a genuine Republican splinter sentiment, which is saying we're not having the SAS and British Special Forces and British intelligence back in Northern Ireland, because we know what they've done before. They've been aiding the loyalists to blow people up, and we're not having them back here. So there's a genuine sentiment there. But then it's also possible that this was a kind of provocation with British agents that may have infiltrated these Republican splinter groups and be egging them on. So the idea being then, of course, that it's a justification in itself. These attacks may be then a justification in itself for bringing back more of the British intelligence, or the MI6 type, MI5 type people, and particularly this group, the Special Reconnaissance Regiment, the SRR. They are like a sort of intelligence version of the operational side, which is the SAS. And you know, this whole area is extremely questionable, extremely secretive, and unaccountable. And of course, it undermines the peace process, bringing these people back in. So I would say there's a sort of manipulated, it's a manipulated by British intelligence splinter groups. So, you know, the good thing about it, of course, is that we've got the broad spread of the Republican view is that this is not clever and that it must end immediately. So this is a very tiny number of people. But all you need, of course, is a tiny number of people to start to destabilise a peace process, if they're doing it in the way that they are, you know, which is to, I mean, it's interesting that they've gone for the sappers. The sappers being the sort of nickname term for the Royal Engineers, because these are explosives experts. So they will feel, you know, the idea, it seems to me, is to make sure that the British Army's explosives experts are the ones that are seen to be under attack. So they don't necessarily have a level view of what's been going on here, and they maybe take a more emotional view, because it's really important, of course, that explosives experts know how false flag attacks happen. You know, say, for example, some kind of NATO operation, for example, like Operation Gladio. And this is when this first happened, this is my immediate thoughts were, is this another something from Operation Gladio, which went right throughout the 70s, 80s and 90s, and was basically NATO intelligence planting bombs, pretending to be the Soviets and pretending to be left-wing splinter groups. Now, they've been basically found out, although many of the press and public don't know about Operation Gladio. It's one of the most important, I think, things that's happened really since the Second World War. It shows that we've got people within the superstructure of our establishment who are actually just blowing us up and trying to blame whoever it is that's the bogeyman of the day.
How about the timing then? I mean, again, we're talking about the British military intelligence here potentially being behind this. And of course, one question is, you know, why do they want to destabilize the region now again? Then we have this period of more of a quiet for a while now. And then all of a sudden this comes up, at least from my perspective, out of nowhere. Why do you think this is being done at this particular time?
Well, I think what's happening is that we've seen over the last couple of years, there's been attempts by NATO and the Western power elite to get wars going in the Middle East. We've had a big attempt to sort of demonize the Iranians, and there's all sorts of other things going on around the world. We've got the India-Pakistan problem brewing away. We've also got North Korea, South Korea problems. But these, it seems has been put on the back burner for a bit by just concentrating on domestic stuff. And of course, Ireland is about as close as it gets. Now, don't forget, of course, that Ireland was the first ever country to leave the British Empire. It was the sort of leader, really, in the
breakout group. Yeah.
Get the British Empire to start to put an end to it.
Yeah.
And you know, fair play to the Irish for getting that all going. You know, because it was the British Empire had, it was a sort of a we were very smart, Britain, as an empire, in that we will go into countries and sort of sort out their water system, give them something, but then we would be taking, like the Romans, you know, taking the tribute from around the world. But the Irish had enough of this over the years, and they'd had enough of the plantations bringing people in. It's the sort of stuff we've seen in, of course, now in Israel, in the Middle East, bringing people in from outside and creating a little tension. I can remember, because, you know, having lived over in Northern Ireland, seeing a lot of comparisons between Israel, Palestine, and Northern Ireland.
Well,
at the time, this is back in the mid 90s, early 90s.
Yeah.
I remember scratching my head, thinking, "Well, is this really the same as Israel, Palestine? What's going on here?"
Well, Tony, just look at the symbolism as well of the Ulster flags and things like that. Star of David's,
right,
red hands. What's going on there? You know.
Yeah, there's a lot of symbolism, and a lot of this is the Orange Order, which of course connects back to Bernhard and the Dutch royal family. You've got a lot of similarity between the start with the Star of David on these symbols, and this is a link to the high, what you say, Royal Arch Masonic type activity, where you see the same symbols in the Royal Arch lodges on the carpets.
Yeah.
So you've got, it seems to me, a sort of an attempt to destabilise the peace in Britain here. And I think it's been wonderful to see that the people have come together marching against this in public.
Yeah.
And we've had Catholics standing next to Protestant and condemning it, which is great. It's one of the first times I can ever remember since the Troubles first started under the role of Bilderberg Chairman Peter Carrington, when he was Defence Secretary, which is when the Troubles started, back in the late 60s and early 70s, and Bloody Sunday, that it's the first time that I've actually seen Catholics, that I can remember, Catholics and Protestants of both the Republicans and the Loyalists standing it together and saying, "Well, look, we're not having this, absolutely not." So it's been great to see that.
Very good. Quickly, do you think that people can, stop this from happening? What I'm thinking about is people have their own kind of, if you know what I mean, intelligence network, meaning that when people who are smart and up to speed and realizing what is going on and potentially how other groups are manipulating the region, do you think that could be something that helps to put a stop to this kind of activity?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's reignited a lot of discussion about the Force Research Unit and about British Army intelligence involvement in Northern Ireland, which is almost sort of healing the wound of last weekend with these three murdered security people, the two army guys and the Catholic policeman. That is the salve which will sort this out. Is if people remember and re go over what the British have done over there, and I think then for the soldiers to see this sort of thing as well, and for the forces to understand that there is some genuine, shall we say, traitors in their midst. I mean, we've got this guy, Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who was involved in all that stuff. He was investigated by John Stevens, and there was a lot of attacks on John Stevens when he was investigating all this dodgy activity, collaboration between the terrorists and the British security forces. Anyway, at least that's been looked into. But Gordon Kerr has apparently been shipped off as one of the more clandestine British Army units actually over to Iraq. And so it looks like he's the sort of guy that if he was to step back on British soil, he may even be arrested after the Stevens inquiry, because, you know, he was clearly shown to be actually making things worse over there. And, of course, we don't need a lot of these sort of intelligence people. We don't need them. I mean, the police are doing their job well and properly, and the police service of Northern Ireland is much, much better than the old RUC used to be, and with more equal numbers of Catholics and Protestants, even though it's still sort of led by the Orange Order and Sir Hugh Orde.
Mm.
There are prospects for peace in Ireland, and it does seem that there's been a very, very good, robust, sensible, intelligent response from people in the north and south of Ireland.
Do you think that this could have anything to do with the fact that Ireland voted no for the Lisbon Treaty? This is a kind of a weird level of retaliation stuff is going on.
I think it's more that the power elite are looking at the Western countries now and thinking we need to destabilize our own home territory so that we can bring clampdowns on civil liberties here at home, so we can then get on and extend our wars abroad. So I don't know. It's like the way I see it may sound a little bit simplistic, but I see it as like the Eye of Sauron in the Lord of the Rings.
Good enough.
While it's concentrating on one battle that's going on somewhere abroad, maybe in Gaza for a while, and then it's concentrating on something else. So the eyes can't be everywhere at once.
That's a good analogy. I totally agree with you there. How about you've been involved here in media ethics, as it were. How about their participation in all of this as well?
Well, of course, the media is key and in understanding what's going on, because there's been a kind of covert takeover of the media without the public realizing. I mean, we had for years here in Britain, the BBC was a very open and accountable public service. Now, it's slowly morphed into this kind of propaganda outfit, which has certain very important events that are taking place in Britain and around the world, which it just simply misreports consistently in a propagandistic, repetitive fashion. You know, having seen this sort of at the sharp end, it's much easier for someone like myself to see this going on and the changes. I mean, I was actually working for the BBC whilst the John Burt changes were coming through. That's something called producer choice, which was essentially a kind of market system within the corporation. And I mean, I was there when you could literally phone up any department in the BBC and everyone would just sort of cooperate with everybody else if they had the time, and which they usually did, because the place was well organized. And then what John Burt brought in after the sacking of Alistair Mill in the mid-80s was this sort of whole form-filling culture. And now we've got a situation where we've got some very, very important stuff which is just simply not being covered. I mean, I'm talking about things like 9/11, I'm talking about 7/7, the attack on London in 2005, 52 people killed.
Mm.
We're talking about things like the Princess Diana, death of Princess Diana, which looks increasingly, even more after the inquest, to have been an assassination by MI6, or you know, certainly in collaboration with other intelligence services, possibly. And things like the Bilderberg meetings, which are becoming more and more significant and still not being covered by mainstream press here. And stuff to do with the Freemason, the power of the Masons, secret societies and the occult. Now, of course, anybody that looks at the origins of fascism in World War II would be looking all over the occult and the theosophists. I mean, there's some really good books on the subject. Probably the best I've come across is Peter Levender's Unholy Alliance, which it really pulls apart the occult significance of the birth and the sort of hatching, the spawning of Hitler and Nazism. And so anybody that's not taking any attention of that, seeing it all as some sort of wacky, kooky conspiracy or a little bit too frightening, is betraying their profession, you know, really, because I think we need to be looking at all these things and understanding them if we're going to be an honest media. And, of course, there's an increasing corporatization of the press, you know. So there's, I mean, this was why Rupert Murdoch's actions were so significant in the mid-80s. Murdoch came in, he bought up the Times newspaper, which was on its knees at the strike, and then he bought up also the News of the World and the Sun newspapers in Britain here. And he was very smart. He broke the back of the British media legislation that tried to make sure that no company could own television channels, newspapers, and all that sort of thing. So that they would only be allowed to own one outlet each. And then there was the BBC kind of hovering in the background just to kind of keep everything sensible. In the mid-80s, Margaret Thatcher and the Tories, they really did smash the newspaper unions. They all do with making sure that there was a plural media. And now what we're seeing is a kind of end game with these big media corporations that now exist in Britain eating each other up, and also sacking lots and lots of journalists, you know, because they're saying, oh, well, there's no advertising money anymore, and we just can't afford you. So, and what, of course, they do is they keep the journalists who write things they like, and they get rid of the journalists who write things they don't like. And this is a, you know, a dreadful situation, and it's not being reported on at all, of course, in most of the newspapers or anywhere.
But they're—I feel that they ultimately are killing their own profession. They're killing themselves slowly, as it were. And I think that all these people who have been denied by you know, working ethically and with morals within the media, they will set up their own shop, if you know what I mean. We have the web information
spreading. Well, it's not that easy. It's not that easy because, you know, you need to have an income, and also many of the journalists, mainstream journalists, have been following a lot of stuff to do with 9/11. But maybe the other stuff they haven't, you know. So it's if we had what we really kind of need in the UK is media proprietors that are prepared to take this kind of stuff on board. And there's precious few. I mean, there are some, you know, you have to search around, mostly on the internet and on there's a program called Edge Media Television on the Sky satellite that does a lot of really good investigative work. But you see, investigative journalism has been killed stone dead. It's really only now almost all opinion pieces by people who are sort of quite right-wing generally. I mean, Mark Steele, for example, in The Guardian, who's a left-wing journalist, who's actually a brilliant comic writer as well, he's been looking at Gaza, he's been looking at the arrest of Muslims in Britain and written some really scathing pieces about the fascist tactics of the police, the racism within the police, and actually being quite satirical and scathing about them. And the independent newspaper refused to print it, even though the guy's a weekly columnist.
Mm.
So we're seeing some real propagandistic sort of turning of the screws in the British press, so that there are certain really important things going on the British public are just simply not going to get to know about via their newspapers anymore.
What about if we zoom out a bit and take a look at the broader picture? Where do you see things are heading, Tony?
Well, it's difficult to know, of course. You know, I've got no crystal ball here, but you know, you can see that with the reduction of civil liberties, with the we've had this sort of militarization thing through 9/11, 7/7, concentrating the public on terrorism, whenever that looks like. I mean, of course, 7/7 itself. I mean, it's the sort of the domestic version of 9/11, I suppose. Took place on a weekend with the G8 summit up in Glen Eagles, where there was a big concentration on solving world poverty. Now, that, of course, was completely smashed when the 7/7 event happened, and everyone suddenly then talking about terrorism. And it did seem like a sort of quite a diabolical kind of way to shift the agenda at this big international summit to make it all about terrorism again and forget the debt forgiveness. But of course, the banking frauds and scams are all coming home to roost right now. And so we're seeing two things happening together, which is two very dangerous things.
Do you see?
Most importantly, the you know, sort of taking away of civil liberties. All I can say is that we're heading towards some kind of sort of social and economic crisis. And I just hope that at least some of the institutions around Europe and around the rest of the world, but particularly Europe and America, where a lot of this stuff is focused, are take advantage of this and use it as a way to engineer a better society. It's likely yes, that they will have to nationalize a lot of these sort of banking industries and similar things, but it's a question of who is going to then control the kind of whatever sort of socialism comes out of it. Let's just make sure it's not national socialism as the Nazis had.
Well, it's going to be international socialism this time around.
That's right, absolutely, yeah, not national socialism, sorry, yeah. I mean, that's what they're going for, certainly, but I don't think that, I don't honestly think it's going to be possible to just throw away these national boundaries, because there is a certain amount of distrust of that. That's the game, I suppose, at the moment, is to try and, as it has been for such a long time, to break down international borders. And we've got this kind of disaster capitalism rolled out. You know, we've had the Naomi Klein's book about disaster capitalism, and it shows that there are people who actually just simply wait for these disasters to come along and make the most out of them. And it is a sort of parasitic form of capitalism, which is, anarcho-capitalism. It's just, you know, survival of the fittest, law of the jungle capitalism, which is, it seems, is sinking Western society. But I've no doubt there'll be a fight back against it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There certainly is already, within the establishment even.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit more about that. What do you see is happening?
Well, there are all sorts of interests, you see, in the establishment. It's not quite as clear-cut as people would like to think it is. It's, you know, there are all sorts of different interests, both from the sort of merchant classes and from the landed gentry. We've still got, you know, quite a powerful landed gentry here in Britain. I mean, I don't know about other parts of the world, but there is by no means any kind of real consensus about what to do. I mean, there's lots of people now saying, you know, in the political classes and ruling classes, that we really do need to take the bull by the horns with the financial system. But then I don't think that necessarily means an international solution. So there is still a lot of British sovereignty style sentiment. Now, quite how that's all going to be realized is anybody's guess. I really can't predict that.
It feels to me like, specifically in the media, they're always trying to put a right-wing slant on that and say that this stems from racism, and they try to always portray it as such, all people who are interested in...
But you see, that's a bit of a tired old joke now, you know. Well, it's not a joke, but it's a tired lie. Mm. And most people can see that, you know, that you know, you can be patriotic and still want to, sort of do this stuff, and that isn't necessarily a problem. But yes, you're right, that's the way it's trying to be... there's an attempt to paint it that way.
Mm. And I think the UK overall, so I've heard at least that UK is the most skeptical nation, as it were, against the EU, for example, and for all these.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that's a real problem, because the Americans wanted us to be a sort of bridgehead into Europe.
Yeah.
But whilst we're also very, very skeptical about the Americans, we're sort of still an island nation. It's bizarre, really, that we're refusing to really embrace the US, even though there's lots and lots of money spent on trying to get us to be friends with America and loads of American programs on the TV the whole time. Yeah. We're still very distrustful of the US state here. I mean, we've always been distrustful of our own state, I think it's fair to say, quite sceptical and independent-minded, and same with Europe. So I think we're still an island nation for the time being.
Where do you see Europe is going in all of this? What will the role of Europe be? Is that only a stepping stone?
I don't know. I mean, I've always felt that the French and the Germans have got a kind of mutual mistrust that is actually quite positive in a way. It's that, you know, that particularly with the occupation of France by the Nazis in the Second World War, and also that the French kind of understand the more than many other people the occult origins of the fascism, and that there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. That there's a kind of uncomfortable relationship between France and Germany, which is in a way is quite positive. Even though you may see it as a bit xenophobic, which is really irritating. It's just the idea that, look, we respect you, but we don't want to be part of what you do. It's like you know, the friend who's a great friend of you, but you don't necessarily want to be living in the same house as them, you know.
Mm.
So there's that sort of feeling, I think, in Europe, and I honestly don't think that the whole sort of EU project is being bought by the never mind the people in these various countries. It's some elements in the establishment are very mistrustful of Europe. And I think the other thing is that they've done a very, very bad public relations job, the EU. Most people now know about the corruption in there, the fact that the accounts of European accounts haven't been signed off for many years, that there's all sorts of problems with their public image. So and their image amongst opinion formers, for example. It's interesting what's happened here in the UK, of course, is that we've had Kenneth Clark, who's the main Bilderberg representative for Britain. I mean, he's one of the real Bilderberg organisers, and I could talk about their links to Freemasonry if you want.
Yeah, definitely. Please go ahead.
So Ken Clark is now on the shadow cabinet. That is to say, he's in the Tory party opposition. I mean, he's been a candidate for the leadership of the Tory party for a long time. But you've got this kind of actually very anti-Europe sentiment generally in the Tory party, which is sort of a bit patriotic and that sort of thing. And yet, right in the centre there, you've got the main Bilderberg guy. So you've got a kind of inherent contradiction constantly in the Conservative Party here in Britain, which is pro and anti-Europe at the same time.
That's pretty
Yeah, anyway, so Bilderbergs and Ken Clark and Freemasonry. Well, I don't know whether Ken Clark is a Freemason, but there's certainly some very, very strong connections between Freemasonry. And all you need to do is go back to look at John Robison's book, The Proofs of a Conspiracy, which some people doubt the authenticity of, but I just challenge people, read it for yourself and see what you think. You know, this guy knew James Watt, the inventor of the steam engine, and he was a Freemason himself, and he could see what was going on within Freemasonry across Europe. And you can see in those original writings, which were translated from the German, leaked material from the original Illuminati, that there was this plan there to infiltrate the Freemasons, because they thought, oh, the Freemasons are a kind of nice little club, no one will suspect us yet, and to create this kind of super masonry, which was very secretive and essentially satanic. And if you look at Bilderberg today, you can see the guy who organized the last conference in Britain, that was in Turnberry in Scotland, is the same chap who, Andrew Palmer his name is, the same chap who's the personal assistant to the Duke of Kent, who's the world's number one Freemason.
There
so
you go.
Don't tell me there's no connection between Freemasonry and the Bilderbergs, please.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's really, really interesting. I think that there's a lot of clues in that area. And, Tony, I
and, of course, one of the things that Hitler did when he first came to power was to stop the Freemason lodges operating, to close them. Now, that wasn't because he didn't like Freemasonry. It was because he realized how powerful it was, because he'd been part of that sort of occult network, and he wanted to make sure that I'm the only occult network in town. Yeah, so that's why Hitler closed the Masonic lodges. And, of course, the Masons often say, oh, you know, Hitler was very anti-Mason, therefore we're real radicals. Well, you know, yes, I think there's a lot of radical thinking goes on in Freemasonry, but not necessarily for the public good.
There you go. Well, exactly. And
it's this kind of anarcho-capitalism. This is the way I see it, anyway.
And it's also that it gives that slant again towards, for instance, anti-Semitism. They tie together people who look, you know, with a bit of a frown, I guess, upon Freemasonry as it stems from some kind of anti-Semitism. And again, these are all, you know, terms that people throw around in order to downplay valid criticism, as far as I see it.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the higher levels of Freemasonry, the Royal Arch and that sort of thing, you've got this very heavy Jewish symbolism. You've got the secret temples that they have. They're basically the big lodges like we have here in Bristol, in the UK. Generally have two actual temples inside the Masonic Hall.
Mm.
Neither of them have any natural light that comes into the temple, and the higher of the two temples, which you only get to use when you're a fully embedded Mason, they are quite dark places. They've got so laid out a bit like a synagogue inside, and you've got the flags of the 12 tribes of Israel in there. You've got big symbols of some of the tribes up on the wall. And it's very heavy sort of Old Testament Jewish symbolism inside there. But there's this kind of also this feeling of, look, this just isn't right. You know, they've done something weird. So they've got this synagogue, but with like two giant phallic pillars in the middle of it. So it seems to me that there's a similar kind of attack on Judaism through high level Freemasonry, through the Zionist movement, for example. And a corruption of the Bible, and certainly as I see it, you know, that what they've done is they've taken some biblical ideas and just completely twisted them to their own devices. As you get in parts of the Christian right in the States particularly, I mean, it's not so bad over in Europe, thank God, but, you know, you've got this kind of weird Christian right that sort of almost, you can almost see them with their finger hovering over the nuclear button saying, hey, Armageddon, fantastic, man. And so there's a similar problem. And of course these religions are really important, these three monotheistic religions, and Islam has been thoroughly it seems to me thoroughly used. I mean, we've got intelligence front organizations around which are these extremist Muslims that don't represent ordinary Muslim sentiment at all. For example, we had a demonstration here last weekend around about the same time as these killings, which I don't think is any coincidence, in Luton in Bedfordshire, with some soldiers that just returned from Iraq marching through the town, and a very extremist Muslim group chanting "British soldiers go to hell" and this kind of thing. Well, most Muslims, they may think that, but they're certainly not going to stand up in the street and shout and scream. You might find the British sort of Stop the War movement doing that, but but you can see the way that these little groups work. There's a degree of real sentiment, but it's also, it seems, there's also a degree of intelligence manipulation to sort of egg them on to be there for the cameras. And then we're starting moving into really seeing the whole of the European world really through the eyes of Guy Debord and the Situationists, with these big spectaculars which are done for the camera, for the television screen. Of course, 9/11 was almost made for television. Everyone in the world watching it live. This, it seems, is the way that the TV and the media are most culpable, is in playing into the hands of those who would use the media to manipulate the public, and in a society of the spectacle with big public events. And all this stuff has gone into really well by the Situationists and the French revolutionary types back in the 1960s, Paris 68. And many people haven't really gone into Situationism, but I think it's one of the most fascinating, interesting artistic movements there's ever been. And probably the sort of fusion of art and politics that really helps to people to disassemble what they're seeing on the television screen, rather than just simply switch it off and never watch it, which is what increasing numbers of people are doing, is to actually get to grips with it and understand, this is that sort of manipulation. You know, like, I don't know if people have seen the V for Vendetta film, where you've got this little child sitting watching the BBC News and getting up saying, well, a load of rubbish, they don't expect us to believe that, do they?
Right, so we get
into that sort of sceptical point of view, where we're reading the news rather and reading information, seeing between the lines, rather than just simply accepting it or switching off, which of course is another thing that they want us to do. Is just think, don't think about this. Go and think about something. Watch an entertainment show.
Yeah.
Watch go to the circus, and don't, whatever you do, get to grips with what's going on in the world around you.
Right.
One of the things which has struck me recently is the death of Morgan Tsvangirai's wife.
Tell us about this.
Zimbabwe,
I don't know what this is.
In a car crash. Now, immediately that happened, the first thing we see on all our television screens is, was this an assassination? You know, and in fact, I read in the Times, there was something. The whole article was about, was this an assassination? Now, of course, it wasn't. It was an accident. But we don't get the same kind of skepticism when someone like Robin Cook, who's the ex-defense minister, who resigned from the cabinet when it was announced that we were going to war with Iraq. Very principled guy, brilliant speaker. And when he died in mysterious circumstances up a mountain in Scotland, there was none of this questioning. So, you know, people are starting to read that, you know, certain things are more likely than others, and that there is a really very, very loyal political press. You know, most of the institutions, it seems to me, are no longer independent reporting houses. They are bought and sold for their political influence. You know, places like the Daily Telegraph and various other big institutions. Yes, bits and pieces of truth trickle out, but essentially they are used for political influence now.
Hmm. And David Kelly, another one, right?
David Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, it was here in Bristol that the programme BBC Documentary was produced, which was actually one of the best I've seen. Looking into the death of David Kelly, and it looks extremely suspicious, extremely likely. Some very well, it seems, liked by the media figures like Alistair Campbell, directly involved, it seems, in his death by the way that the information was leaked about who it was that has been speaking to Andrew Gilligan, and of course. The whole business being now proven to be absolutely right. Of course, Kelly was right on the ball. He was an internationally recognised expert, and he was just about to step onto television to tell everybody that the war was based on a lie. And of course, the other thing that this does is send out a very, very clear message to other people working for the government with inside information, never to speak to journalists. Otherwise, look what happens to you.
Yeah, and it feels like. The plan, if you will, to release the information that the war was based on a fraud has been was just delayed a little bit. It was like David Kelly was a few years early almost, because nowadays we're being slammed with this information in a way. in many cases, and a lot of mainstream television is covering this fact that it was based on a lie, but yet at the same time it feels like nothing is being really done about it. You know, we have a new administration in the U.S. now.
We're moving into a sort of lawless stage, you know, where the due process of law is not taking place anymore in these really significant events. Let's look at the Diana one, for example. I think this is one of the most significant stories of the last sort of 15 years or so, because it seems to me, you look at the inquest, which only took place last year. That's more than 10 years after Diana's death. What we had was, this is I think the third or fourth coroner, because the previous coroners had refused to do the job. It seems they must have been lent on by somebody to do stuff, and they just refused. So finally they managed to find a coroner to do the job and to look through all the details to do with the death. And then the prime suspect, who Michael Mansfield, the lawyer, and Mohammed Al-Fayed had fingered as the person that, through all their research, had seemed to be involved with the Duke of Edinburgh. And the Duke of Edinburgh didn't even come stand as a witness in the inquest. So that seems to me absolutely ridiculous. If you've got somebody that it seems is the prime suspect in a possible assassination or a suspicious death, and that the prime suspect is not asked to answer questions. But not only that, okay, even the list of questions, Mohammed Al-Fayed's lawyer had something like 30 or 40 questions, very specific questions about specific incidents, times, dates and things that he wanted to ask the Duke of Edinburgh. Even that list of questions was kept secret from the press. There was a gagging order placed by the judge on it so that no one was allowed to see what questions it were, but there was that Michael Mansfield was going to ask the Duke of Edinburgh if he came. So, you know, we've got an absolute farcical travesty of justice going on there.
Yeah.
But I don't think most of the British public are fooled by it. You know, I really don't. There's a lot of sentiment here, very pro-Diana. And there's a really good interview, if people have never seen it, which was done by Panorama. This is an interview in 1995 with Diana, after it was revealed that she was having problems with the marriage, etc., and to sort of put her side of the story, really. So there was an hour, a 48-minute long interview with Martin Bashir at the BBC with Diana, and it was the biggest audience that programme had ever had.
Mm-hmm.
Right, this is an investigative documentary series, which is a shadow of his former self now, but back then it wasn't so bad. And if you actually go back and look at that interview with Diana, you can see the absolute psychological torture and psychological operations which were being used against her. You know, things like having her private phone calls published in the national newspapers and this kind of thing. So she was absolutely being isolated. There's a real attempt to isolate her. She talks there in that interview about having her mail interfered with, so that people were writing to her with sympathy and she was never getting letters. And there was a lot of support for her and her position out in the public. And it seems to me that there was a massive sentiment in the press and public, which was pro-Diana, and that someone somewhere just simply decided that this woman is too much of a problem for the royal family. I mean, the way she describes the royal family also is an extremely cold and manipulative bunch.
Yeah.
You know? And I think most of the British people have had enough of them.
What do you think will happen? Do you think we'll... I mean...
Well, the big question, of course, is when the Queen dies. This is another thing which is nobody really seems to be, you know, sort of daring to discuss. But of course, it's really important. What is going to happen to the country?
Mm.
Are we going to still be a Christian nation? Are we? Who's going to take over? Because Prince Charles has said that he's most definitely not a Christian. He doesn't want to be the defender of the faith. But no one really knows what's going to happen. I can't see Charles taking over and being a successful monarch. I just don't. Well, I know it won't work because there is so much controversy to do with the stuff he does. I mean, he's just been in the papers again last week selling this kind of quack medicine, which people are saying, well, what is this stuff? It's some sort of weird tincture, and you're selling this as some sort of cure-all remedy. And so he's constantly in the public eye here, and very often in a negative light. So the idea that he could be a credible monarch, I can't see it somehow, especially after all of the poisonous stuff that's come out since Diana died. Mm. You know, she was such a popular person, and he wasn't. You know, he was clearly cheating on her, etc.
Well, there is so, talk about bypassing.
You know, that is a really interesting one. I would imagine possibly William will just, you know, it will skip a generation and William will take over.
Right, right. Do you think that's a possibility here? I mean,
absolutely,
I've seen...
yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think Charles's eyes are set on, you know, international activities and sort of climate change type stuff rather than, you know, sort of taking over the crown here.
Well, he wanted to be king of Europe, wasn't he?
Sorry?
He wanted to be king of Europe, didn't he? Like, leave a petition for that or something?
I think he wants to be king of the world, really.
Well, there you go.
Anyway, we'll see. But, I mean, you know, he's also got a very, very powerful, extremely well-funded public relations operation here in Britain, which just, I mean, and also intelligence gathering, so that if anyone is thinking about writing something about Prince Charles, they will probably get a call saying, we know you're doing this, you know, lay off, and what about this and this and this. So any journalists writing stuff about Prince Charles have got to be really on the ball. So that's another problem. I mean, it's just what is going to happen with Charles. No one wants to talk about it, but I mean, I certainly do. I think it's fascinating.
Well, it is. Hey, listen, Tony, maybe we can begin to round things up here for this time. I do want you to talk a little bit about your websites, and also, of course, mention a little bit about your upcoming appearance at the AV2 conference here in London at the end of May.
Well, I think I would like to end a bit, really, by talking about some of the solutions to all this stuff, because it seems pretty clear to me that unless people are focused on what kind of world they do want to see, then they're sort of sucked into this nightmare game of the war on terror and the financial collapse. It seems to me that the practical stuff is going to be that, well, for example, here in Britain, we've got about 60 million acres of land and we've got about 60 million people. There's plenty of space for everybody here. It's not as if we can't feed ourselves. We're just in a little magazine called The Land Magazine, which I help edit and I contribute to sometimes. We were looking at this whole problem of, can Britain feed itself? Because we're getting massive amounts of imports of food. We've got this whole sort of supermarket monopoly or organized cartel, really, of distributing food. And yes, we can, you know, is the answer. It's not really a problem feeding ourselves. It's just that the supermarkets have become the distribution network, just as Standard Oil became the oil distribution network in the United States in the early part of the 1900s and caused so many problems. And by monopolizing these corporate organizations, monopolizing things. Here in Britain, I think we're going to have some sort of, I hope anyway, some sort of a renaissance where people start getting back in touch with self-sufficiency and the things in life which really matter. That is to say, more labor-intensive industry and farming, that sort of thing. Because what we really need is to see, I think, that there's plenty of wealth around us. It's just a question of making sure that everybody has access to it. And nobody needs to be excluded from that at all. Everybody, there's enough space for everybody. Everybody can have land to build a house on if they want to, or to live on. And what's happened over the years is slowly but surely the earth underneath us has been privatized, and we just need to deprivatize it and take it back. So I think that's essentially one of the most important messages. To get out about what the solutions are. You know, the idea of big multinationals, some guy in a big office somewhere pressing a few buttons and sending in the agricultural machinery to over, you know, vast areas of Lincolnshire or somewhere is just not on. You know, everybody needs to have access to land. Everybody needs it.
Yeah.
And also, we need a fair and equitable system for distributing food. I mean, this is just a sort of basic starting point, as well as all the other utilities. You know, after the Second World War, we had a fantastic organization of, you know, various sort of gas utilities, electricity, water, all that sort of stuff, was really well organized in a very publicly accountable fashion and very cheap, because there was no fat cats taking profits out of it, and there's no shareholders. So that's the sort of system I think we want to get back to. And there's lots of people, and old Labour people, old trade unionists, because, of course, the war on terror is also a war on the trade unions as well, because it's a war of privatisation. Everything is privatised, private security, all this kind of stuff. So that's what I see for the future. And when you're talking about the event taking place at Heathrow in May, what I'll try and do with that is to keep it as current as possible. So whatever stuff has been happening, we'll talk about that, because that's what I can't predict obviously what we will be talking about, but obviously that kind of thing. And also, I want to give people at that talk a real glance behind the scenes in the media to see how things work, because we have some real allies in the media, even though there's not that many of them. And there are a lot of people who are journalists who are also extremely sceptical about the people they're reporting on. But they're in a situation of fear, and the question is, how do we break that deadlock?
Absolutely. So we have a few websites here we can give out. Mention a few of your websites again, Tony.
Well, my main website, really, just as my own sort of personal as a freelance journalist site, is publicinterest.co.uk. That's www.public-interest.co.uk. That's sort of where I hang out. But then the main research site is bilderberg.org, B-I-L-D-E-R-B-E-R-G, bilderberg.org. And we'll go back to the Bilderberg Hotel there, and where it all started. Pretty much in Oosterbeek in Holland, back in 1956.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem to me that if you don't get that 9/11 was some form of an inside job, and if you don't get the Bilderbergs, you don't get a lot of stuff. So, I mean, getting your head around 9/11 and Bilderberg is doing a long way to understanding, you know, what is really going on in the world today. You know, why is it that NATO is encircling Russia? What's going on here?
Mm.
That sort of stuff. You can get to the bottom of a lot of it by looking at the sorts of decisions which are made at these Bilderberg meetings.
Okay.
So then there's also dialectradio.co.uk, which is a weekly podcast we do here in Bristol, which does is a whole mix of stuff, really. It's great fun. And what we do is we do a mixture of sort of arts and culture and bits and pieces of national and international news. Usually it's sometimes bits of local news too. For example, we had an arms fair. There was an arms company down in Brighton, which was decommissioned by a bunch of people who were from Brighton and London and Bristol. So there were some Bristol people involved in it, and we've been talking to them about why they decided they wanted to go and decommission this arms factory,
mm-hmm.
which was supplying missile parts for the Israeli Air Force.
Hmm. That's very good. Interesting.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's just that the idea really is to try and put it as a platform, really, for local talent, because so much local radio, I don't know about in other parts of the world, but certainly here in Britain, much local radio now has been basically commercialised and privatised.
Yeah.
And it's just literally an organ for the music industry to churn out its rubbish all over the population and local talent.
Yeah.
It's hardly getting a look in. So we try and make sure there's plenty of, you know, sort of exposure for local talent on our show.
Very, very interesting. So there's a host of different websites to check out. And again, I will have all these linked up on redicecreations.com, so you can find them easily, many of Tony's websites. And then again, of course, I want to mention thealternativeview.co.uk, where you can find out more information about the speakers, tickets, times, dates, and all of that stuff about the Alternative View 2 conference at the end of May.
My talk will focus on the media. It's a real good look at the global media. Where is it going? And, you know, how can we get around it? And how do we read between the headlines?
Very good. Looking forward to seeing that, Tony. Thank you very much for coming on again. And I guess we'll see each other down in London at the end of May, then.
Fantastic. Right. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Cheers.